The Guardian.
Hello, sports, and welcome to issue 7 of Andy Zaltzman's Summer of Sport, the every sport apart from football sportcast. Sport, the show that offers humanity a refuge from news in the comfortingly irrelevant bosom of sport in what is proving to be a rather stressful and difficult geological epoch for our planet. Thanks, Peter Sport. Joining me on this week's show, from The Guardian, Simon Burnton. Hello, hello, gentlemen. How's sport treating you this summer, Simon?
It's been treating me rather well. I know the Olympics yet to come.
So. Are you going to it?
Oh, I'm not going to it, no.
All right.
But I may stay up quite late some evenings to watch it.
Rock and roll. I'll be doing that. And comedian, politics nut, and boxing fan, Matt Ford. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here to
the show. Are you excited about the Olympics?
I have to be honest and say, at this moment, not massively.
Right.
But once it starts, I will be. I know I will be. I've planned to be excited once it starts. But that excitement isn't yet tingling in my guts.
Right. So I'm trying to recreate the feel of London 2012. So I'm getting my wife to wear a flammable-looking purple shirt and a big foam finger and pretend to be one of the volunteers and just point me towards the television.
Yeah, so. Get her to work for Group 4 and let a load of burglars in the back of the house.
Anyway, before we move on to the main part of the podcast, a quick update on all the sports news from the sports world, and let's begin with golf. After a sensational two-day shootout with Phil Mickelson, Sweden's Henrik Stenson won the Open, as predicted on this show last week by golfing soothsayer and harbinger of truth, Andy Parsons.
So we've got to go for prediction. Is this what you want from us?
Yeah, I want a prediction.
But I'm going to go with Henrik Stenson.
Right.
Mainly because he had my favourite comment on the Zika virus, and he said, I'm not so much worried about mosquitoes, I'm more worried about bears.
So there it was. We told you what was going to happen, and it did happen. And Henrik Stenson, of course, referred to this in his press conference after winning the Open. We've translated it from the Swedish for you.
Phil missed his eagle putt, so it looked like it was going to go in, and I expect him to make every...
When I heard I had been predicted to win by Andy Parsons on the Summer of Sport podcast, I knew it was my destiny, for Mr. Parsons knows all things and speaketh naught but what is true and what will become true. I could have played with an umbrella as my driver and Jeff Boycott's mother's stick of celery as a putter, and I would still have fucking won. But I didn't, because it would have looked cocky.
Henrik, Andy Zaltzman, Guardian Summer of Sport podcast. After winning the Open, what is your next goal in golf?
Nothing, Andy. It was not about winning the Open. It was about being predicted to win the Open on your Summer of Sport show. It was such a great thrill for me, because I have been listening to Andy Zaltzman's Summer of Sport ever since I was a little Swedish boy, and I always dreamed of being predicted to do something on it.
Andy Zaltzman, Summer of Sport. So, gents, you guys, this week, you have to live up to Andy Parsons' predictive genius.
Oh, God.
So I'm going to put you on... I want predictions. Who is going to win the following events? A, the Labour leadership contest.
Jeremy Corbyn.
You reckon Corbyn...
I just think the numbers are so powerful for him.
Right, you don't.
I don't think the argument's going to make any difference.
See, it would be more interesting if it was a bit like golf, and there were 128 candidates, and they had to whittle them down. And then you got.
It was more of a tournament, sort of, with a group stage, and then something like that, perhaps.
A halfway cut.
Yeah, I just think, given that especially that they reckon 60% of the new registered supporters this week are Corbyn fans.
Right, and Phil Mickelson fans as well, ironically.
Indeed, yeah, there's a great Venn diagram of Corbyn supporters and their golfing superstars. I think it's Corbyn.
Simon, who's going to win the solar system planet of the year this year?
It's hard to look beyond Jupiter, I think.
Right.
It's that red dot.
Yeah.
That hot spot.
Right.
The other planets just can't match that.
Yeah. Because you think Earth is someone who's got so much going for it, but we seem to be in such a self-destructive phase at the moment that I think we'll be lucky to make podium this year. And whether or not Pluto's allowed in. I think they're still waiting for the piss test to come back. Let's move on to cricket. And Pakistan beat England in a mesmerically brilliant first test at Lord's. A superb performance by the 42-year-old captain, Misbah-ul-Haq. and his team, particularly the leg spinner Yasser Shah, took 10 wickets in the match. Misbah, he is older than me. I'm 41 and three quarters. And there are very few active sportsmen older than me in a sport that involves at least some running. So he is my hero in life now, Misbah. You're 33?
33, yeah.
Simon?
I'm 41.
41, so yeah. You're right in...
So the dream's still alive
for us. Yeah, the dream is still alive. I can't think of any other... Can you think of anyone in the same age bracket? There's the old darts player in Dartford.
Yeah, Olympic equestrianism is... always there, like it's the yeah. beacon of hope.
But that's sitting down, isn't it? And just
it is sitting down. But I think the British team has a 58-year-old, a 56-year-old,
right? Horse or rider,
right? Yeah, right. Human. So
there was a few goalies knocking about on there. Yeah, but wasn't Dave Besson on the bench last season at the age of like 55 for Fleetwood Town or something like that? Yeah.
But it's not leading your country to a Test match victory at Lords, is it, sitting on the bench for Fleetwood Town, with all due respect to Fleetwood Town?
Oh, absolutely true. Well, I'm just trying to think of duffers that are still knocking about to make you two feel better.
Simon, you're a big, big cricket fan. Were you doing the over-by-over during that?
No, I was camping.
Oh, you were camping? Yeah. So did you see much of the...
Very little, sadly.
Right. It was an absolutely classic. I think England were very unlucky, though, in that the ball kept missing their bats and hitting the stumps. I mean, that was... you can't legislate for that. It's physics, isn't it? Also unlucky in that they still haven't learned to play leg spin in the 110 years since the South Africans confused the shit out of them in the early 1900s. Just bad luck, really. I was at Lords on the Friday, and that was the day Mohammed Amir, the convicted spot fixer, made his long-awaited return to the international, well, to the Test match arena. He's played one international since his ban ended. And there was a lot of talk, would he be booed by the Lords crowd? And the first time he'd batted and bowled. And he got quite a polite reception, and you know, everyone seemed to have sort of got over it. But Nigel Farage was there that day, and he was walking up and down the stairs at the side of the mound stand to get up to a seat. And every time he walked up or walked down, he got booed by the crowd. And to me, this is one of the greatest moments in British history. We showed our great British values, the values of forgiveness, the values of tolerance, of welcoming someone back into the fold, but also our preparedness to boo a tool. So.
With Cameron at Wimbledon and Osborne at the Paralympics.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are, I mean, for electorally, these are dark days for left-wing politics. But in terms of, you know, openness for sporting abuse.
Yeah.
But you'd think, wouldn't you, that Farage at Lords is kind of as close to his crowd at a sporting event as he's going to get.
Right.
He's going to have more, perhaps, sympathy there right. than he would.
Says a lot of people wanting other people to get out.
Oh, God. It's like Cameron standing on the terraces. He'd get any politician right. went to a football match would be torn to shreds.
Right. Yeah.
Surely you think at Farage, there must have been a few people thinking, oh, quite nice to see him.
But I don't know. He didn't get many cheers, certainly.
Well, it's those shy UKIPers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very shy.
But anyway, it was a good moment for cricket.
Did he take it well?
Yeah, he loved it. Absolutely. I mean, it was kind of pantomime booing, but even so, he was grinning. He was, you know.
I think
it was probably one of the highlights of his career. Mm. Booed at Lords. Doesn't get any better than that. Let's move on to the big story this week. Doping! And, well, I mean, it's been a huge, huge story in the great annals of sporting cheating with, was it Russia... The Russian Olympic team now facing a complete ban. The Court for Arbitration of Sport has just upheld the IAAF's ban on Russian athletes competing. And, I mean, there's been some spectacular cheating scandals in sport. I think in most sports in the 20th century, ethics are just the county cricket team that used to be really good in the 1980s. Thank you, Rush. And the latest report revealed that Russia conducted a state-sponsored doping programme in both summer and winter Olympic sports over several years. The World Anti-Doping Agency investigation found that the Russian sports ministry had been, and I quote, very, very, very naughty indeed. They had directed, controlled and overseen manipulation of urine samples, including in the Sochi Winter Olympics in Russia. Now, this was a glorious story, that they had put a cheeky little mouse hole in a wall from which they nicked Russian athletes' urine samples and swapped them for clean samples. Now, you would have thought, would you not, gentlemen, that the IOC might have been a little bit more alert to this kind of thing. They might have said to themselves, should we check that no one has drilled through the wall to steal the WAS tubes? Nah, I'm sure it's fine. This is Putin's Russia. They'd never do something like that. I mean, it's absurd, isn't it?
The mouse hole was, you're right, then that was the glory moment. Yeah. And the added salt, that was, I didn't know that from earlier reports. They added salt so that the clean urine matched the density of the of the dirty urine. So right. They don't test for salt. And
salt is not generally viewed as a performance-enhancing substance,
no,
is it?
No, and the main test, I suppose, is taste.
I would never be motivated to cheat to the level where I'd want to handle someone else's piss.
Right.
Just the thought of holding a warm tube of wee that's come out of someone else, I'd immediately go, I don't love my country this much.
Right.
Let's just try and get fit.
Naivety.
I don't like having to provide my own sample. I mean, not in a sporting sense. I've never been dope tested.
Right.
But I go to the doctors. I had to go in Edinburgh a couple of years ago when I got ill. And it's a horrible thing trying to aim into a tube.
Right.
Have you ever had to do it?
It should be an Olympic sport.
It should. Yeah, that itself. Urine samples itself require an accuracy that is arguably professional.
You could stand closer to the tube, Fordy. I mean, that's one option, isn't it? Anyway, I digress. The International Olympic Committee, the president, Thomas Bach, described the commission's finding as, quote, a shocking and unprecedented attack on the integrity of sports and on the Olympic Games, which, of course, is the IOC's own job, and they do not rely anyone muscling in on their territory. Russia's response has been basically to say, what a load of rubbish, in tabloid headline style. The Kremlin put out a statement. And, you know, just the words Kremlin and statement. I mean, those two in the same sentence. I mean, it's going to take a long time before we stop thinking, uh-oh, this is bullshit. I mean, they've got...
It's tantalising, isn't it? It's a kind of cliffhanger when you hear Kremlin statement.
Yeah.
You think it's going to be a real treat.
Literally anything could happen from there.
Yes.
I mean, normally you've got a fairly, you know, straight level of narrow perimeters.
Yeah.
But when it's a Kremlin statement...
Yeah, all bets are off. They said the report is accusations based on the testimony of, quotes, a personal with a scandalous reputation. Which is a lovely kind of 18th century way of... quite scandalous, looking at a lady's ankle in public. Described it as a dangerous recurrence of interference of politics in sport. Now, when you are being accused of political interference in sport by Russia, that is... Well, that is, you've got to admire the barefaced balls of the Russians for that. That is spectacular. And I mean, Putin is—he's a hard man to trust, isn't he? I mean, you don't really want him involved in anything, really, particularly not sport.
Just on every level, I would never want to compete in Russia.
Yeah.
I don't want to go there ever now. I was sort of tempted for sort of future sporting events to want to go, and you just think it just sounds like the least trustworthy regime that you would ever want to compete under, especially when you're dealing with sports drinks and things like that and supplements.
Yeah, Matt, I mean, we just had the Brexit vote. We're supposed to be building bridges with countries outside the EU, of which Russia is one, and you're really not helping things.
Well, I don't think, like, surely that. This isn't going to be the thing that stops Britain getting global trade deals. I would just be... I mean, but on a serious level, what they did to Litvinenko, you just think, I don't want to... I wouldn't. If I was an athlete, I wouldn't want to go there.
Yeah.
I'd be so scared. I mean, energy drinks look reactive anyway, don't they? Powerade and Monster and things like that look like they're sort of part nuclear.
Yes. Now, there are further details. I mean, they covered up 580 positive tests. A lab in Moscow destroyed 8,000 samples... Presumably based on your view that it's wee, it's disgusting, let's just get rid of it. A key FSB agent had apparently had access to the Sochi anti-doping lab disguised as a sewage and plumbing contractor.
Brilliant.
that should have raised suspicion, shouldn't it?
That's like something from an Emilio Estevez film.
Oh, it's the sewage down again for the 14th day in a row during these Olympics.
Who was it? Did you say the FSB as well?
Yeah, so that's the old... The
Federation of Small Businesses. Well, the plot thickens.
It's the rebranded KGB, isn't it?
Right.
You know, give it a new name. Everyone thinks it's like Snickers and
they've rebadged it.
I'd say I'm more tempted to look kindly upon attempted cheating if fancy dress is involved.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Now the IAAF, I mean itself is a sporting body. I mean, they like I said, their ban on Russian athletes just being upheld. They basically have a reputation of being slightly less trustworthy than the average Sicilian mafioso. And because they found that, that some of their senior figures had been blackmailing athletes, covering up drugs tests, stealing IAAF branded pencils from the stationery cupboard, all manner of subterfuge. And is there anything in sport we can? I mean, it's left Seb Coe sort of looking like the boy left standing on the burning deck whence all but he had fled, with people asking why he did not notice that everyone else had been dousing the deck with petrol and flicking lighted matches over their shoulders. Could he have done more? I don't know. I mean, it's. Does it, Simon, as a professional sports watcher, do these kind of things undermine your love of...
Well, in retrospect, they do.
Right.
At the time, the 100 metres in 1988, you know, they're talking about the women's 1500 metres in 2012 in similar terms now. You know, if the race at the time is brilliant, then I have a brilliant time watching it. You know, but the people who it really hurts, the people who run clean and finish sixth.
Right.
Or fourth, or wherever. That's their life, and their goal has been taken away from them through, you know, dishonest means. You know, fans want a show. They want a race.
Yeah.
Give them a race.
Yeah, ironically, a lot of people who lose cleanly do end up turning to drugs after defeat. If only they'd done it the other way around.
Right.
Life could have been so much better for them.
Yeah. Have you ever cheated at sport, Fordy?
I mean, the occasional handball and a bit of a shirt pull on a five-a-side game, but nothing major.
Yeah.
I would say that was more bending the rules than breaking them. I would say that was gamesmanship,
have you ever
psychology.
Have you ever cheated at stand-up?
In what regard? I mean, some people would say...
punchline-enhancing substances or anything?
I don't think so. I don't think anyone who'd seen me would ever suspect that.
Has it reached the stage now where we just can't trust sport? And what we need to do is get the athletes out of athletics, get the sports people out of sport, and instead have international sport done by some form of random selection. So you get a far more accurate reflection on what countries are like as sporting powers. If you weren't just choosing the elite, you were choosing just ordinary people. So done, almost like jury service. Oh, you've been selected to run the 1500 metres at the Olympics.
Yes, but given how we've played football in recent years, I would suggest that the results might not be that dramatically different.
Right.
That you think we might as well have fielded a pub team in some of those tournaments. I mean, I'm not allowed to talk about football, am I?
Not on this show, mate. This is a no-football show.
Ah, damn it. Well, other sports.
That's right, we have a two strikes and you're out policy, so you've got one more chance.
I'd be up for that. That'd be good. And then you'd get the thrill of potentially playing in a sport.
Yeah. There was a big documentary about the 2012 opening ceremony on the BBC earlier this week. And the thing that made it beautiful was that they literally picked, you know, anyone could volunteer, and people of all shapes and sizes were welcomed and put on into the Olympic Stadium and told to dance.
Yeah.
And, you know, that gave hope to every one of us.
Right.
And maybe this is the way to do it.
Yeah, I think this is the future of sport.
Kind of like jury service, though. Could you turn it down if you had some TV work?
I've no idea, that's too hypothetical for me.
Repeat after me, I do solemnly swear by almighty sport to watch the sport, the whole sport, and nothing but the sport. So help me sport.
More people have been dropping out of the Olympics due to the Zika virus and other reasons as well. I mean, Olympic golf is really being severely undermined. The world number 357, Krevel Terpwitz of the USA, he's actually pulled out of the 2020 Tokyo Olympics because he's worried about getting some wasabi in his eye if he eats out at a sushi bar, which he says could affect his putting even as far ahead as the 2021 Palookaville Invitational. Whilst the world number 2016, Ignatius Petrogenesis of Canada, he's pulled out because he thinks that if a golfer plays in the Olympics in the same year as his ranking, the world will end. Apparently it's in the Book of Revelations, if you read it backwards in the voice of treacle-toned American sportscaster Jim Nantz. So, facts. And we've talked through this series about other sports that we'd like to see in the Olympics that would be bring more to the party than golf. What, Simon, is there anything you'd like to see that's not there currently?
I mean, genuinely, I don't understand why squash isn't in it.
testify. Yeah, we talked. Yeah, I'm right with you on that one.
Yeah, it's been squashed in the Commonwealth Games. You can. It's good on television. Spectators can watch it in place. It's played around the world.
You can play it anywhere. You can play it in your house. You just need a room and a ball and some rackets.
Yeah.
I mean it's not classic squash. The right, you know, any room. Any room will do.
Scrabble is easier.
Yeah, yes. Well, would you like Scrabble in the Olympics?
No.
Right. Because there's some big Scrabble events coming up. British Scrabble Association Championships. All the pundits are saying this could be a big year for vowels. 40, what do you like to see in the Olympics that's not there?
It's commonly said, but darts.
Darts.
And I think that would really liven the Olympics up.
Yeah.
Because there's so much emphasis on fitness at the Olympics that actually to have highly skilled sports people plying their trade. I just think the Olympics, for me, always misses that. I want to be there in fancy dress with sort of bawdy messages written on whiteboards.
I mean, you should just get darts fans to pick up another sport rather than actually having dart. You know, have them going
the javelin,
to
the maybe
small ball rifle shooting.
Yeah, do it like the least bawdy. Maybe it would be dressage or something like that. I mean, it's not even.
I don't know. Could a horse dance to that music? I don't know.
Let's find out.
Yeah, head to head javelin. I'd like to see. I'd like to see. You know, one at either end of the stadium trying to pick each other off at a range of 85 meters. Joust. Apparently, jousting is making a bid.
Oh,
proper medieval jousting.
Yeah, I mean, can see that.
That would be a huge success, I think.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Or but motorcycle jousting. I mean, that you could do in the athletics track, couldn't you? Just start on opposite sides of the stadium.
To the velodrome.
Meet at the meet halfway up the home straight. Bang.
I think just in general, bring back medieval sports.
Yeah.
What other ones are there apart from jousting?
Well, yeah, play cart victim racing.
Some falconry based.
Falconry would be a sensational Olympic sport. And that is so. That is. I mean, I don't know how you what you get the falcons to do, but. I mean, yeah, if you get a falcon to pick up a Russian test tube of piss from one end of a stadium and bring it back, that's everything you need in an Olympic sport.
If horse dancing can make it.
Exactly.
Then why not?
Yeah, it's another form of racism, isn't it? If you allow horses in but not falcons. The Zika virus has, of course, been playing havoc with the men's golf lineup, and some tennis players dropping out now. And we've had a lot of criticism of the sports stars for pulling out. But I thought it's time to get another perspective on this story. So this week, I spoke to the Zika virus. Zika virus, thank you very much for joining us on the Summer of Sport.
Thank you for having me, Andy.
Zika, with so many top golfers and some tennis players pulling out of the Olympics and blaming you, you've had some very negative press coverage in the sports pages as of late. How has that made you feel as a virus?
Well, it's all part of the job, Andy. We're not there to be popular. As I always say, a popular virus is an unsuccessful virus. We've just got to do what we have to do as professional viruses and not worry about what the media says. And you can only be what's put in front of you, can't you? That's what they say. So it's up to the medical scientists to do what they have to do to hit back. So, and if they end up beating us, well, you just got to hold your hands up and say fair play.
Do you have hands?
Don't have hands, Andy. I'm a virus. Figure of speech, mate.
Yeah, well, so, Zika, plenty of viruses have ultimately lost that battle with science.
Oh, here we go.
Does that concern you, that all this coverage is actually making it more likely that you're going to go and end up going the way of smallpox and being eradicated?
Well, Andy, the fear of eradication is always there as a virus. You can't escape it. And we know how good medical science is these days. There's no shame in being eradicated. In many ways, it's an honour. It shows they respect you for what you do. And well, look, if we can achieve even 10% of what smallpox did, then we'll have had a good knock, so no complaints.
Right. Now, until recently, Zika.
Zeke, please.
You weren't nearly as well known as some other viruses you're quite similar to.
How does that feel, Andy?
Yeah, OK. But the Olympics has really thrust you into the public eye.
Oh, yeah, it's been absolutely great for us, the Olympics. I mean, you know, as a virus, if you want to make it big, you've simply got to get Western attention. That is rule one of being a virus. You can't be happy being a dev world virus these days. You've got to get into the European media, US, you know. So, yeah, it's been a great opportunity. It's a godsend.
Well, an IOC send.
Well, they're basically the same, Mandy. God and the IOC. All-powerful, unaccountable, unable to deal with viruses.
And you don't feel guilty at all, Zika, about the suffering you've caused to thousands of innocent people?
Mate, I'm an enveloped an icosahedral flavivirus with the 10 kilobase positive sense RNA genome. I can take a bit of unpopularity. I'm like an Australian cricketer. I don't mind it. If anything, I thrive on it.
Now, obviously, it's not just you as viruses that are behind this recent success, Zika. It's been a team effort, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely, Andy. I mean, we couldn't do it without the mosquitoes, and it's been a terrific performance from them. And they've got such experience in the disease-spreading game. It's been great to work with them, and it's really made it easy for us as a relatively unsung virus to get out there and put the numbers up on the board. So, all credit to the Aussies. They're right up there with the best of them. Been there, done it. You know, your malarias, your dengues, your West Nile fevers, you name it, they've spread it. I mean, we're really just a Chris Froome to their team Sky.
So are you not concerned about the damaging effect you, the Zika virus, are having on the return of golf to the Olympic Games?
Well, of course, Andy. We love golf. Most viruses do.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You've got a lot of time to kill as a virus, waiting for the call-up to get out there and infect something. So there's always a lot of golf on in the common rooms. But it's not our concern. I mean, I was talking to VZV the other day.
That's chickenpox.
Yeah, that's her.
Her?
Yeah, her. No big deal. Anyway, she was giving me all kinds of grief for keeping the likes of world number 329, Brendan De Jonga of Zimbabwe, away from the short-awaited return of Olympic golf. But you've just got to laugh about it, haven't you? I mean, chickenpox. We always tease her about breaking the strike. Scab. Crossing the picket line. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Thank you, Zika virus. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Andy. Love the show.
Cheers.
I'll come to see you at the Edinburgh Festival.
Please don't. Stand. 3:40. August. Boxing. Now, we've talked quite a bit about boxing during this series. We had Carl Donnelly on a few weeks ago, a huge boxing fan. You're quite obsessed with it, aren't you?
I love it. Yeah. I love going to them. And I'm trying to get my girlfriend into it, right. Into watching. I realised how dark that sounded. There is something, because I started out on a different sport that we're not allowed to mention on this podcast. and then there's an adrenaline to that sport of being there that I wanted to get elsewhere as well. And I remember first watching, I think it was Bruno Tyson. I think that was the first time I remember reading a newspaper. So I must have been 6 or 7. I remember it being on the front of the Daily Mail and just being bewitched by this fact that these two guys were going to fight each other. And I couldn't believe that it was allowed. And every time I go to a boxing match, part of the entertainment is in that sort of narrow band of your brain where you go, this, I mean, it must be okay because there are people here and everyone else is allowing it to go ahead. And I think that's where the tension, that's where the enjoyment is contained. And then you start to appreciate it as a sport and for the technical side of it, the ability for people to read their opponents at such close quarters, not just to understand the sport on a psychological level and a tactical level, but then to be able to deliver what's required, the fitness required as well. There's not a single thing about the sport that I don't like. Right. I love hearing it on the radio, I love watching it on TV. I love the way they talk about these fighters. Karl Froch, of course, an absolute throwback, involved in an absolute barn burner with Kessler at the O2. 12 toe-to-toe rounds, but he faces George Groves. And, you know, just the way that they sort of growl about these things. I love it. There's not a single commentator I don't like. I love Buffer being there. All the sort of countdowns and all the hype.
What does Michael Buffer do the rest of the time?
Well,
Basically, he has an entire career just going around the world saying, let's get ready to rumble.
Let's get ready to rumble. And it's just, the thing is as well, he sort of builds up, so even that is like his money shot. So he will sort of build the tension around hearing that and go, ladies and gentlemen, for the millions watching around the world and the 20,000 attendants at London's O2 in conjunction with Matchroom Sports and Hennessy and all that, and you just say the flipping thing. Are you ready? And you go, just say it. Let's get ready to rumble. And everyone goes ballistic.
Right.
But he does that, which was the question. And what he's also done is he's patented it.
Right.
He's copyrighted it, sorry. Yeah. So then he has also done adverts with puns. I think he also copyrighted Let's Get Ready to Crumble for an American sort of lasagna topping or something.
Right.
But I don't know what else he does, but I think he's had a bit of work done.
Right. What, on his face or his voice box?
I think he's had a facelift.
Right.
But he's still a legend, isn't he?
Yeah.
But whenever he's there, you're like, well, this is definitely a big fight because Buffer's here.
But I just wonder how he fills the rest of his time because, I mean, he's got to run an owl sanctuary or something.
he must just... I imagine he watches a fair bit of boxing.
Right.
And he looks like he looks like a sort of guy who exists on yachts.
Right. Yeah, he does.
He's the sort of guy that would say, oh, you know, he was at Donald Trump's party the other night. Buffer was there. I bet Buffer's just on the party circuit.
Right.
You don't get that good by accident, though. You must put in the hours.
Well, just practice saying.
Yeah, I reckon 4 or 5 hours a day.
Right. Yeah. I mean, his wife must be pretty bored of that by now.
Yeah.
I mean, I try some of my material out on the missus, and it doesn't always go down well. But if it's just one catchphrase for 40 years.
Yeah, especially if you send it in the bedroom as well. It's not. Can we just not rumble tonight? Can we just do it tenderly?
Now, some big fights imminent. Oh. And you're particularly excited about Gennady Golovkin. Triple G.
Triple G, indeed.
Versus Kell Brook.
Oh, Kell Brook.
In September.
I first saw Kell Brook fight on the undercard of Froch Ward out in Atlantic City. Right. And I'd heard of Kell Brook, but I'd never seen him fight before. And he reminded me of a young Mike Tyson. Broad-shouldered and punched really hard. I thought, oh my God, this guy looks like a real piece of work.
Right.
And he looked psychopathic in the corner. I thought, oh my God. And I got so excited about it. And then I saw him interviewed afterwards and he's all like, I like Amir Khan, you know, I'd like to fight Amir, but I don't think he wants to fight me. Right. It's just, one of the great things of boxing is these people look like the most terrifying people in the world. And after the interview, they're actually very softly spoken, decent, calm men. And I was just beguiled by him. And then I recently went to see him fight Kevin Bisio at the Sheffield Arena, and that was over very quickly. And Kell Brook is one of those. Part of the problems with boxing is that people aren't forced to fight the best, which is why we had to wait ages for Mayweather Pacquiao, and which is why we had to wait ages for Lewis Tyson. And by rights, Kell Brook and Amir Khan would have fought each other now, but they're allowed to dodge each other because of the way that boxing is effectively run by promoters and TV companies. So the fact that he's taken this massive, bold move of fighting arguably the best pound-for-pound fighter in the world in Golovkin, who's a seriously dangerous fighter, just says to me that, firstly, Kell Brook is highly ambitious. Equally, he's prepared to lose, which so many modern boxers aren't. But you get better fights then if they have a rematch and you get these wonderful trilogies that evolve. So in every regard, I'm just so excited. And I really hope he wins, obviously.
Has he got a chance?
He's absolutely got a chance, yeah. And it's definitely, Golovkin's already said it's the hardest fight that he's faced. Right. But Golovkin looks a lot more dangerous.
Yeah, see, I won't fight if I think I'm going to lose.
If you haven't
really held my boxing career back. No, not physical fights. I've had some verbal fights with audiences mentioning no Manchester Comedy Stores. Now, but it's a very exciting time for British boxing.
Oh.
But I mean, what is making us as a nation much better now at punching other people in the face? Cheap lager. You don't think is it a legacy of the Blair years, making us more angry and divided as a nation?
That's a heck of a theory.
I mean, the Chilcot report didn't. I mean, bizarrely, in 2.6 million words, did not look at the effect of the disagreements over the Iraq War on the rise of British professional boxers.
Well, a lot of sports did well in the Blair years, obviously,
right.
As a result of increased investment in sport in schools. I'm not sure how many school sports days involved 12 rounds of 3 minutes. I think the 90s were a golden era of boxing, and then that will have inspired people like Cole Froch and the others to take it up.
Right.
So I think it coincided with the Blair era rather than being
caused.
You don't see many boxers saying, "I'd just like to thank Tony Blair for invading Iraq," because without that, I wouldn't have had the anger inside me to want to wallop other people.
It's always the subtext, though, isn't it? Cole Frampton is. He's fighting next weekend, is it?
It's July the 30th in New York.
Right.
He's fighting for a world title, undefeated. He had a great fight earlier in the year with Scott Quigg, and that was one of those fights that people wanted to happen and was able to happen quite quickly. His nickname is Brick Fists.
That is a good nickname.
That's a great nickname.
Yeah, we talked earlier in the series about boxers' nicknames and the lack of Anthony Joshua having a decent nickname. Brick Fists is...
That's really...
Superb.
Horrible, isn't it, really? What would yours be?
I don't know.
The Z-Man.
Z-Man, I mean, it's not frightening, is it?
No, yeah. I'd probably just have, like, the pasty or something like that, or something food-related.
Yeah, I haven't given it enough thought.
The problem is we don't know...
Email in suggestions.
I think we need to see you fight first, and then we can sort of base it on your fighting style.
The fleer.
Yeah, the crier.
The coward. he's fighting Leo Santa Cruz.
Yes, he is, yeah.
Who's Mexican. Now, I have a theory, Mexicans never lose in boxing.
They are phenomenal in terms of producing fast, hard boxers. And a particular weight as well. It tends to be sort of in the lighter weights, doesn't it?
You're right.
The hand speed of these men.
Because the sombrero was developed as a boxing aid, wasn't it? That, you know, to... So you could get better at, you know, keeping your opponent at a distance. So the sombrero was the optimum That was, you know, a training when you were young.
No, that's true. In the Mexican Parliament, the two dispatch box are two sombreros lengths apart to signify peace. And I'm just trying to think of other national stereotypes.
Well, let's probably leave it there, shall we? Let's probably just leave the casual national stereotypes there. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Summer of Sports Sport podcast. Simon, thanks very much for joining us, 4D.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks. Do you want to plug your Edinburgh show?
Oh, yes. It's on at 4 o'clock.
Right.
It's called It's My Political Party and I'll Cry If I Want To. And that makes it sound like it's just a song title with the words political party in it. It's not a sad show, it's happy. And it's at the Pleasance Courtyard, 4 o'clock every day.
There you go.
3rd to the 28th.
So we're competing for the massive political comedy audience. Huge big money market.
But what it means is, because people very rarely go for one day, so they can see you one day and then see me the other.
There you go.
So we're in harmony with each other. We're a coalition.
And so you've just written a massive article, I believe.
I've written some stuff on the 66 World Cup for the 50th anniversary.
Right.
Which will be online, certainly, in the next week or so.
Right. Well, you're allowed football if it's at least 49 years ago, so I will allow that reference on this show.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Until next time, listeners, goodbye.